What's up, friends? It's DGS on DHP, and today's guest is Barbara Costner. Barbara has been a member at Hinson since 2005. Barbara and I share a birthday, August 12th, just in case you're keeping score at home. And Barbara has been through a lot in her life. She shares stories or scenes from her life. That's the title of her self-published book, which she talked about in the library for the Meet the Author thing a few months ago. Anyways, we thought it would be really encouraging and enjoyable to hear of Barbara's testimony and some of the things that she's gone through in her life. I think it will encourage you and give you perspective. We have two episodes on Barbara Costner. Enjoy. Well, Barbara Costner, welcome to the Disciple Hinson podcast. It's good to see you. You told me you've never listened to a podcast before, and now you're on a podcast. So you're jumping right into the deep end.
Yeah.
Barbara, why don't you just tell us, introduce yourself to our listeners. So who are you? Who are you related to here at Hinson? How long have you been here? Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Barbara Costner. I was born in London and came to the United States in 1971 after a great deal of traveling around. I've been at Hinson regularly as a member since 2003. So I've been here 21 years, and my daughter Ingrid also attends here.
Tell us a little bit more about your story. So you were born in London, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so, and were you raised in a Christian home?
Well, my mother was the dominant person in our family. My father, due to war work, dropped out of the family life, and basically I grew up with not knowing him. We hardly ever saw him. My mother was the leader in the family, and she attended an Anglo-Catholic church in London, which was extremely strange. I've never known another church like it. It was an Anglican church, but the pastor, who was newly appointed when I was about 11 years old, believed that the Church of England was the true Catholic Church in England. And for him, the ritual was all that mattered. So from a sort of very easygoing Church of England service, when he was appointed, he made sure that all Catholic entrapments, as I think of them, were introduced into the church, that is, vestments and candles and incense. We had to sing in plain song. We couldn't sing normal hymns. It was all in plain song. It was just, we had to attend Mass on holy days of obligation, which came up several times, about 10 times a year, which was in addition to the Sunday Mass that we had to attend. And we were told specifically, if you don't attend, you'll go straight to hell if you don't attend. It was a mortal sin. So everybody was constantly having to go to confession. And then, it was just an enormous effort to try and fulfill all these different requirements. And not only this, but it was taking up an enormous amount of time. I had to attend church four times on Sunday, for communion at 8, high mass at 11, Sunday school where I had to supervise the children at 3, and then evensong at 6. And then also during the week, there were some evening services, and it was just becoming a terrible chore that I didn't believe in and I resented. And so when I got to the end of my school years at age 18, I decided I couldn't stay at home and go to university in London and live at home with this this religious structure in my life. I didn't believe it. I didn't want to believe it. And so I decided to go away to college as far away as I could get, because I thought, well, nobody will ever visit me in the north of Scotland. So I went to St. Andrews University on the east coast of Scotland, simply to get away from home. And correctly, nobody ever visited me there. And it was just such a relief to be on my own and to be able to make my own decisions, which of course meant that I didn't attend church. I didn't believe in it. And the St. Mark's Anglo-Catholic Church was the only thing I knew. And so I didn't want any more to do with it. And so for years and years and years, I never attended church, never thought about it, didn't care about it. And I married somebody who also was running away from home for very different reasons. He was brought up on a farm. It was a very extraordinary situation. His parents were highly educated statisticians with degrees from Edinburgh University, which they gave up during the war to do war work on a farm, which they knew nothing about, really. And so the seven sons, had to do all the farm work. And Donald, the third son, just really resented this having to work every day of the year on the farm. And so when he arrived at the university at St. Andrews, he also was fed up with home and just looking for a new life for himself. So that was how we sort of met up. We were both there for sort of very negative reasons, I suppose.
And so, and this is who you ended up marrying, is that correct?
Yes, I married him. My mother died at the beginning of my second year in college. My father was just out of the family. He just couldn't cope with anything. We never saw him. My sister was engaged and got married just about that time. And so I had no home left. My sister was living in my family home with her husband. And I had nowhere else to go but back to college. And so at the end of our third year in college, Donald and I got married. As I look back on it now, mainly for sort of negative reasons, that we were just trying to find a new life, but escaping from what had not satisfied us earlier in our lives.
Barbara, thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your kind of growing up years and going off to college. Before we kind of fast forward to how you were first introduced to Christ and became a Christian, can we hear a little bit more about your childhood? Is it true that you were living in London during the time of the Blitz?
Yes, the Second World War started in September 1939, and I was just 6 years old in August. At the time that war was declared, I was on vacation with my family, and instead of coming back to London, they dropped my sister and I off at distant relatives in Somerset to escape the war.
Kind of like in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, right? Just like
I suppose so. We'd never met these cousins before, okay. My sister and I. But this proved to be one of the happiest events of my childhood. They lived out in Somerset, and my Uncle Reg, who was a second cousin of my grandma, a very distant relative, was a bank manager, and they lived in a beautiful little village. And we just loved it. They were renting a farmhouse. The farmer was called up to war, and so this uncle and his wife were renting the farmhouse. And so there I was, living on a farm with all these animals, big cart horses and sheep and cattle, lots of chickens, ducks, It was just an amazing thing for a child from a London suburb to be there out in the country with all these animals. And one other thing that really made me very, very happy was that the local school had no room for me. They took my sister in, but with the disruption of the war and refugees flooding out of the country, a lot of the country schools were overburdened. They didn't have the teachers nor the room. And so I was turned down, and I had a whole year just living on the farm, just having a wonderful time there. After the first year, when nothing had happened, it was called the Phoney War, we came back to London in 1940, and that was exactly when the Blitz started. We came back to London, and a week later the Blitz started. And this was pretty terrifying. I mean,
you're 7 years old now.
I was just seven years old. The sirens were going off just constantly. There were air raids every single night. We couldn't sleep in the house because the main danger was that you would be trapped in your own home and be killed by the building falling down on top of you. So we used to go out to the public park where they had public shelters dug as tunnels under the recreation ground. This was about a 5 minute walk away from my house. And so everybody about the same time in the evening, about 6 o'clock, we'd all walk down together to the shelters. These were underground tunnels. They were very damp. The floor was just mud, puddles, wet. The bunks were like 3 tiers high on both sides, just wooden. You had to take your own mattress, your own blanket, everything that you needed. There were bare electric lights at very distant points, and it was not comfortable.
How long would you spend in those?
Well, we'd spend the whole night there. We'd sleep there every night. Okay. And you couldn't really sleep very well because people were working round the clock. People would be sleeping there, but they'd have to get up at sort of 11 o'clock at night and go and do war work in the factories. They would be on the night shift from 12 until 8 in the morning. And then other people would be coming back in at 12:30, 1 o'clock after their shift. So there was constant movement of people going in and out, going to work. There were children crying, and so we didn't get much rest. But we did that for weeks and weeks on end, months, I think.
Do you remember, Barbara, like as a child, your memory is astounding to me, how you're able to remember the details from this time, but obviously something so traumatic sticks in one's mind and so unusual. But would you ever pray during that time? Did you believe, like, you know, did you find yourself calling out to God, or did you believe in him as a 7 year old child?
I can't really remember. I do remember that every Sunday we went to church with my mother, mm-hmm. which at that time was just a regular Church of England.
Right.
And it was at that time, from very early age on, that my mother and sometimes my father as well would sit there in the pews. It was a very, very small church, only about 30 people attended. But we did hear the gospel and the epistle. The same 52 were read each year on each Sunday through the year. They would read the same epistle and the same gospel. So we heard.
Do you remember
52.
Which one?
Well, we heard the 52 excerpts from the Gospels and 52 excerpts from the Epistles.
Oh,
and
I see.
So each year you would hear it again, you see.
Yeah.
So my sister and I, when it sort of took our fancy or it interested us, we'd look at each other and smile and say, oh, that's a comfy word. I like that. And that was things like, I am the good shepherd, and Be Anxious for Nothing was another one. Mm-hmm. And these sort of things. So I would remember these, and we'd always sort of think, oh, the comfy words. But I didn't know where they came from. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who said it, what the context was, but it just sounded nice. And these sayings, these verses, remained in my mind until, you know, 40 years, 50 years later, I could remember them all, even though I'd never written them down or knew anything about Wow. them. They came back into my mind, which was to me amazing. So I would say these sayings over to myself, not knowing what they meant
Yeah.
or anything about Jesus or the resurrection or the crucifixion. I knew none of that. It was just way over my head. I never really understood it at all.
Yeah. Now, that sister that you would turn in church as a little girl and talk to, is that the same sister that I would have met who came and visited for your 90th birthday party? Is that the same sister?
Oh, no. Okay. That was my daughter. My sister married when I was still in college and lived in the family home. That's why I didn't sort of have a home anymore.
I see.
She married a Catholic, Roman Catholic, and as far as I know, never really understood the gospel. She just followed the Catholic doctrine, you know, of you need to go to Mass, you need to go to confession, you need, you know, it was all works, which seems to be very much the Catholic way of worship. And that was her whole life,
okay.
really.
Okay. We kind of went back in time to your childhood years, but earlier you were talking about meeting your first husband, and then you went on to have five children, as you mentioned. Do you want anything from that period of your life after you were married? You said kind of in negative circumstances, or at least like both you and your husband were kind of running away from certain things. What maybe share a little bit about that season of your life, of family life, for Barbara?
Well, we got married while we were still in college. Both of us just sort of disillusioned with our home life. We saw nothing for us there. My husband certainly never wanted to go back to the farm. After he graduated, he got a scholar. He had to do 3 years national service. It was 2 years minimum, but if you went in as an officer, which graduates from universities could do, you did 3 years. So he did 3.5 years in the Royal Navy immediately after graduating from college. And during that time, I had the three oldest children. At the end of his national service, by this time he had decided that he wanted to be a university professor, and this meant that he needed to get a doctoral degree. And luckily, it was just a fantastic gift. He gained a scholarship from Australian National University in Canberra, and immediately after completing his naval tour of duty, we went by ship out to Australia and stayed there for 3 years while he did his PhD. And he did this on research on the South Pacific Islands, specifically the French island of New Caledonia, which is about 1,000 miles off the east coast of Australia. So we went to Australia, lived there for 1 year, which we really enjoyed. It was very, very nice. We just loved Canberra. Then we went for 1 year to New Caledonia, which I had thought was going to be a South Pacific paradise, but turned out to be a horrendous, terrible experience because there was literally no food there to eat. I mean, it was just a barren desert type island. It was just it was a huge, big nickel mine, open cast nickel mine.
So what did you eat that year?
Well, we had practically nothing. We just starved. It was a French island, so luckily they were very good at making French bread. The island grew very good coffee and also mandarin oranges. And those three things were our staple diet. There was nothing else. The milk was all sour, so the only thing you could do was make yogurt with it. So I had a little yogurt making thing. There were Vietnamese people there who tried market gardening, but it just didn't work. And by 1960-61, they were all turned out and sent back by the French government to Vietnam. So the market gardening economy just collapsed. There was nobody else could do it. The local people, the indigenous Melanesians, had a hard time. They grew enough food for themselves, but nothing to sell. City dwellers, who were either the French colonial administrators or the mining operators and people who worked in the mines, were earning huge salaries, and they were able to afford imported food, which was flown in each week in great big crates from Sydney, Australia. And so you could order these crates, and one crate would feed two people for 1 week. It would have meat and fish and canned goods, fresh vegetables, canned fruit, fresh fruit, everything you need, flour, sugar, everything for two people for 1 week. But we couldn't afford that. We were on a university scholarship with three children at the time, and one more was born there. Adrian was born in the Melanesian hospital there in Noumea. And we just couldn't afford it. We just literally starved for that year. It was a terrible experience.
So, and that does sound awful. I can't imagine eating coffee or drinking coffee, French bread, and mandarin oranges for a whole year. I might use that with my children when they complain about the dinners at our house. But so where did you go from there, Barbara?
Well, then we returned to Australia, okay. And Donald wrote up his thesis. And then at the end of that year, when he was looking for a job, he got a position as a lecturer at the University of Malaya in Kuala Lumpur. So we left Australia, went to Kuala Lumpur, and that, I suppose, was a turning point in our marriage. Donald absolutely loved it there. He was sort of adored by all these young Malaysian students, and just that's just what he lived for. Our family was very, very unhappy there, the children. They went to local schools, which was very, very difficult for them. The local schools had all Chinese, Malaysian, Malayan, Indian children, black straight hair, dark complexion. Our children were blonde with short, curly blonde hair and pink faces, and just never fit in. They were just joked and laughed at. And when I took them to school, the local children were generally accompanied by their amas. These were servants of the family who would take the children to school, and they would wait outside the school for the 3-4 hours that the children were in class. And so in order to get into the school, you had to walk past this line of amas, and they would all poke our children, pull their hair, touch their skin. And so we ended up with constant problem of ringworm all over their heads. They had to have their head shaved. Ringworm, it was just, we couldn't cure it. It just went on and on. As soon as they recovered from it, it would come again. And so the children hated it. They never had any friends there. also, the climate is steaming hot. It's just like living in a steam bath. It's just 3 degrees north of the equator. And so when you got home from school, nobody was outside. All the houses had a chain link fence around them. Everybody was inside. There was no chance of meeting anybody, any friends, and they were all local children who sort of seemed to think that our children were, I don't know, they thought they were monstrosities or just too unusual to befriend. They'd never met people like them. And so we lived there for 8 years.
Oh, my.
And it was a very, very, very difficult time.
Hmm.
My children had no childhood friends at all that time that we were in Malaysia.
Is that where Ingrid was born then? Was it in Malaysia?
Ingrid was born there in Malaysia. Hmm. Yeah. The other four were, they came with us. It was so difficult. We did, at the end of the first 3 years, we went on 6 months leave back to Britain, met our family, and then Donald had a job at the University of Strasbourg in France, and we lived in France for 3 months during the semester and then did a tour of Europe. And during that time, I said, you know, I really, really don't want to go back to Malaysia. But Donald insisted, and so we all went back again. And at this point, they did go to the garden school, where I became the principal in 1967, which was the only English school in Kuala Lumpur. And so it was a very small school, just for expatriate children. We had, well, the... there was a large elementary school, which my children did attend when we went back after leave, but there was no secondary school. But the parents wanted a secondary school so that they didn't have to send the children back to Europe or Australia or New Zealand for secondary education. They wanted to keep them with them in Kuala Lumpur. So a secondary school was started. It had a very difficult first year, and after 1 year, it was closed down through total mismanagement. And at that point, I took over the administration and the teaching in the school, and starting off with five students and three teachers, we built it up. And by the time I left Malaysia 3 years later, it was a flourishing secondary school with 40 students. They were from all over Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, Thailand, and Canada. We had a huge variety of number of nationalities there.
That's impressive. Did that make, with that school, did that make being in KL a little more tolerable for you and for the children?
Yes, I really enjoyed the schoolwork. That was what kept me going. I mean, Donald was off doing his own thing with all these students, frequently taken off for weekends, saying it was a geography trip, but the school really enabled me to keep my sanity there. I really enjoyed it. It's now a huge, flourishing, amazing school called the Garden. What do they call it? I think it's called the Garden Secondary School now.
Still going
Garden
to
International School. It's a huge school now. It's one very elite school with marvelous results. They get students into Ivy League colleges in the States, Oxford and Cambridge. It's just an amazing school.
Wow.
But it started just with the five children and three teachers, including myself.
That's incredible.
So
and then where did you go after Malaysia? Where did you guys move?
Well, after Malaysia, Donald had come to the United States on leave and had found a job, had been hired at Arizona State University to teach Southeast Asian studies. So this seemed a huge relief that we would finally be leaving Malaysia. He apparently applied for a visa. I don't think now, looking back on it, he even mentioned that he was married. But he obtained a visa, but nothing came for me. And I kept saying, well, you know, how about my visa? When's that coming? And he said, well, you have to wait. It'll come. Well, by the time he left teaching in Kuala Lumpur, we had to leave. And as I didn't have a visa, he sent me and the five children back to his parents in Scotland and said, wait there until your visa comes. I'm going off to Arizona, which he did. So I arrived in Scotland with nothing. I had no money, no house, no phone, no car, nothing. His parents had rented a house for us, but being retirees from this very derelict farm that they had run, they did not have the money to support five, six extra people. They had seven sons of their own. So I was just left there and not knowing what was going to happen. And after about 6 weeks, Donald suddenly arrived on the doorstep on his way to Arizona with his long-term girlfriend on his arm and said, I want a divorce. I'm going to the States with Ivy. We're going to live in the house. We had already bought a house in Arizona when he had applied for the job there. You're going to stay here. And that's that. And the next morning, off he went. And so I was just left there, stunned, absolutely not knowing what to do.
All you had been through, after all he had put you through, I can't imagine, like, the rage or the... I mean, how did you respond or cope at that time? I mean, you have children to raise at this point. How old are the kids?
Well, let me think. Leslie must have been about 12 or 13. Angela was 11. Ivanin was in the top elementary class. He was 10. Adrian was 8. And Ingrid would have been 5. And he just... left us there with nothing. He had been having different girlfriends for the whole 8 years that we were in Malaysia. But
and you were
usually
aware of that.
Yeah, I was aware of it. But usually when these students realized that he was a married man with five children, they just dropped him. But for these young 18, 19-year-old Malaysian girls, many of them thought, well, if we could just marry one of these foreign lecturers from the United States or Britain or Australia, this is a way out of our life here in Malaysia, which is a third world country, and we're not doing too well here. If we could just marry one of them, that would be a wonderful way out. And so a number of these single lecturers did marry local girls. But Donald was married with five children. And I don't know. Well, Ivy, the latest one that came to Arizona with him, she was very, very stubborn. And I remember thinking as I looked at her, she is well named because she is very stubborn and very clinging. She was always clinging to Donald. When he said goodbye to me at the airport, she was there, clinging on his arm, waving goodbye. And now she turns up in Scotland on his arm, saying, oh, you have to divorce Donald because I'm pregnant. I'm expecting a baby, and you can't expect me to go through this unless we're married. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. I have five children. Donald is the father of five children. And you're telling me just to run off. Mm-hmm. So I was furious. His parents were furious. Mm. Luckily, he had a brother, an attorney in Edinburgh. And through this attorney's office, he said, I can't take the case because it's my brother, but the lady in the office will counsel you. So I spoke to this attorney, and she said, the best thing you need to do is get yourself to the United States because you own a house there, and Donald has a good salary there as a lecturer. Financially, you need to get yourself there because you have nothing here. Although I had a degree from Scotland, this was January, and I wouldn't have been able to get a teaching job until the following fall in September. And I had no means of support for that 9 months, and I couldn't rely on, I didn't think Donald would send me anything, and in fact, he didn't. So she said, you need to get yourself there. And I thought, well, I don't even have a visa.